Jaguru, everyone.
Jaguru, welcome to our next episode of the Yogananda podcast. We're going through the autobiography of a yogi line by line. We have reached, well, we have been in chapter 12 for a long time and we're still in it. We have part 10 of chapter 12. We have a full house today. We have Lauren, Priyank, and Chris. How's everyone doing?
Fantastic.
All in different locations.
Yeah, I got to say Jai Guru this time to open, open the pod. That is a privilege.
Yeah.
Jai Guru, everyone.
Jai Guru. Yeah, I hope nobody will be confused by that because we're so used to hearing Priyank saying it.
So. First time in 2.5 years.
Strange. Yeah.
That's good.
So let's jump right into it, right? Part 10 of chapter 12. Chapter 12 is the years at my master's hermitage. Him is Mukunda or Paramahansa Yogananda, and his master is Swami Sri Yukteswar. And he has arrived at his hermitage a few episodes ago. And in this episode, he goes into more detail describing his guru, Swami Sri Yukteswar. And he puts an emphasis on how he is a man of the East and the West. And he, the way he explains it is he says he's an executive Occidental in his outer habits. And then he is a spiritual Oriental on the inside. Yes, Priyank.
So he says that we should be living liaisons of the West and the East. What did you... Oh, this is the first time I've heard of words such as living liaisons. Mm-hmm. Did you guys have an opinion on what that meant? I just thought it to mean like an ambassador, you know, ambassador of what may be good and pure. What do you think?
So the way I understand liaise is also something that connects, right? So I would have thought, like, I think the word you used, ambassador, is really good. Someone who is of both worlds, someone who can be building bridges between the two worlds, maybe in that sense. Sri Yukteswar was definitely that. Yogananda was definitely also, he had that quality, came to America, having been from India in a time when this wasn't so common, and he became... he spent a lot of time in America and became an American. And so he was also a man of both worlds, say the least.
The word liaison really, to me, triggers like a working relationship. And when I read the next couple of words, it says Eastern and Western virtues, Western and Eastern virtues. So does that somewhat mean that we have to work to produce the virtues of our cultures? We must actually be living workers, that we must work to manifest these virtues. Could it be a literal thing? But I think I agree with everything that you said, but when I read this, actually, when I stopped to think about it, because I didn't think about it before, could it be that he's sort of saying that we must work? And Sri Yukteswar was a disciplinarian in some sense, that maybe this could be along the lines of what he's talking about here.
Yeah, I like that. I was just Googling the word liaison, and it had like the meaning that we described earlier, and then it also said it can also mean thickening of a sauce, but I couldn't really. really doesn't make that much sense in this context. But if you think about it, Swami Sri Yukteswar, when he's an outward Occidental and an inward Oriental, for his peers and for his environment in India, he must have seemed like someone who is. Someone who is a fan of the West, someone who is interested in the West. And that might not have been that popular at this time. There was a time of British occupation in India, so might have been somewhat controversial, but he was more interested in the underlying principles of the East and the West, and he talks about them. He talks about the virtues of the West that he holds high and finds important to embrace no matter where you live in the world. And some of them that he mentioned is like progressiveness, resourcefulness, hygienic ways. So that was maybe the contrast between East and West was also more stark back in those days than it is today. I would assume that this is the case.
Yeah, we saw in the last episode the individuals that were mentioned in the footnote number 15 that we just ended the last episode on. And that was talking just about this topic, wasn't it? That there was a renaissance or a revolution with the ideas of treating germs and how diseases spread. So yeah, very, very much so. It was on the topic of the days, really, at the time.
Very interesting point, Mike, that you make about it not necessarily being too popular, i.e. Being very pro-Western ideals and values and features in India, because of course this is in the early part of the 20th century we're talking about here, 1910 or something like that, that he's referring to his time in with Guruji between 1910 and 1915. So there's two things happening, I think. The intelligentsia and the academic circles and the political classes, they were very much trying to copy the West, right? And dismissing not just Eastern ways, you know, culture, but also they were trying to mimic it and try and create a similar system in British rule in India. But then there was also this the rise of independence movement and the rise of nationalism, and which is like it's been that fire has been slowly, you know, burning, and it's quite a big fire right now in India. So that fire was, you know, Gandhi literally encouraged people to forego their Western dress and Western cloth and, you know, adopt Indian Swadeshi cloth, Indian manufactured, you know, the simple ways. And then there was a big shift in the political class to, you know, mimic our traditional Indian roots. So there was this shift, and this was about the time that you'd say that it was kind of happening. So that's a very interesting point. But Sri Yukteswar is interesting here because he says progressive, resourceful and hygienic ways of the West. And that's something that we can probably relate to, the four of us, because when you go to developing countries and you compare that to what we're used to in Europe and the US, hygienic is a case in point, isn't it? You have, I'm in Egypt right now, it's a similar kind of setup. But in India, we have, like, you know, quite a lot of pollution. We have quite a lot of, you know, infrastructure such as sewage systems that need to be vastly improved and things like that you wouldn't really see in most of the Western countries, but obviously it's a kind of a path that's a long journey, isn't it, for countries like India and others in that kind of economic space. But the other thing that I wanted to say was that bribery and corruption is also one thing. Like, I think in the West it probably does happen, but like completely behind the eye of you know, the general public, whereas in developing countries that's quite rife, and these days in India you'll get much less of it than you did even a decade ago. But that's the kind of thing that I think Sri Yukteswar was talking about. And of course the economic differences between the, you know, the organization of the whole industry and the system of the US and Europe compared to India back then was essentially incomparable, and that was obviously a lot of that was down to all the occupations and things like that. So it's a very interesting point you make, Mike, kind of a very long thing, have discussion we could have around each of those individual points. But it's very interesting that Svyogdesha ends it with the ideals of the, you know, religious ideals of the East, give it, you know, the centuried halo, which are beautiful words.
Yes, and as we know, we are souls and we reincarnate, and we don't really remember our past incarnations, but we take with us our habits and tendencies. And if we are someone who is born in the West and has tendencies towards Eastern culture, Eastern religion, there is a good chance that you might have spent a previous incarnation in the East. And the same way, if you are born in India and you look to the West and you admire some of their achievements, you might have lived in the West before. And Guruji wrote a really nice chapter in Man's Eternal Quest. It's called The Soul's Journey to Perfection. And there's a little section there that it talks about the exchange of souls between the East and the West. Lauren, do you mind reading the first part of this?
Out of millions of people, you have been drawn to this temple because you have had something to do with the Orient and its spiritual teachings before. Now that you are an Occidental, outwardly, other Occidentals may laugh at you for going to what may seem to them a heathen church. Those who feel a prejudice against the East did not recently come from there. But those who feel a leaning toward the East were probably born there in a recent past life.
By such indications, one can distinguish Oriental and Occidental souls. Did you, from early childhood, enjoy the fragrance of incense and stories and pictures of the East? Such inclinations would show that you had been quite recently in contact with the Orient.
Very, very interesting. That would imply that the three of you are probably Indians in a past incarnation.
For sure.
I
don't know,
maybe I was a oil baron Westerner, perhaps.
Yes, I can see that.
How the tables have turned, eh, guys?
Yeah.
India's what the world's is it the world's largest population?
No, yes, it is.
Three.
A couple of months ago
this year.
And that's a lot of people. You know, there's only 60 million in, you know, 60, 70 million in the UK, for example. So it's churning through. Lots of people hopefully get the opportunity to walk in maybe Guruji's steps and walk the soil of India, you know, to their benefit, which is interesting, isn't it?
And I thought I was special. Now you're... in the right population.
Yeah, you make a good point, Chris. Yeah. In terms of math, this is actually really difficult. You have 1.4 billion Indians, and then in Europe and the US combined, you have half that, maybe. So, yeah. But very good point. I don't know how it works. Yeah,
but at least gives everybody a chance. to...
So three of you got the short straw then, hey?
we're just liaisons, mate. We're just liaisons.
we're ambassadors of the Eastern culture. Yeah.
Yeah. Living liaisons.
Living liaisons.
Yeah. I think there must be a lot of this happening in the past century, right? People who have been switching from the East to the West and have been going to different, have been growing up in the different cultures. Maybe that's also a reason why it seems like the world is connecting more and more. And certain virtues that Guruji describes here, that not necessarily Western virtues or Eastern virtues anymore, but they become universal virtues at some point. Yeah. So then, yeah.
this is what I think we covered it before, but Guruji was saying that he was familiar with the knife and fork, you know, and that wasn't something really that in India was, right. is commonly used. So he made this connection to say that he recalled having this favor to use the knife and fork, which is not something commonly done or previously commonly done in India.
That's right. Yeah, that was in the first chapter. I think he even says he remembers England. Isn't that right? I don't remember. Yeah. Well, so then he continues and talks about the importance of discipline in Sri Yukteswar's ashram. And there's a sentence that I don't know if you guys feel the same, but I feel like I have heard this sentence a million times, and I found it funny, but also very telling. He said, "Discipline had not been unknown to me. At home, father was strict, Ananta often severe, but Sri Yukteswar's training may not be described other than drastic." And every time I read that, I have to chuckle a little bit, because it is you imagine you have found a loving guru that will show you self-realization, but it doesn't mean that you are almost there. That means that your training has just begun.
Yeah. I was just wondering who out of us would sign up to training.
Okay.
I don't think it would be that popular. If that was on the advertising, you know, leaflet, drastic training, you only get like the Iceman kind of type people would sign up for that, because we like to be gently submerged, like getting into a hot bath, you know, dipping our pinky toe in first and then gently lowering ourselves into that bath. I don't know where I've heard this, but it's the soothing to the ego treatment, I quote, can't remember where I've read that, but that feels like it's an apt term for the majority of us these days, isn't it?
Yeah, Richard Sharp would be like doing a cold plunge every day, you know, versus I think the answer really is that not many people would in reality. Not many people are actually up to the task, myself probably included. You have to seemingly sacrifice so much, you know, in your actual life, in your social life and everything else. Sri Yukteswar didn't have many followers that were dedicated followers like that. He wasn't, you know, he didn't have throngs of disciples. So that maybe tells us something, that maybe not everybody was actually willing to put themselves through such a rigorous disciplinarian sort of regime like Guruji was.
Mm-hmm. Chris would probably ask Sri Yukteswar if you could dial in via Zoom from Spain.
Really like the travel. Yeah.
What about you, Mike and Lauren? Would you sign up for drastic ashram training?
You want to go first, Mike, or shall I?
It really depends on the circumstances. I think if it was offered to me right now, like all of us would have had the option to become monastics, not actually to become it, but to try to become it. I don't think any of us went down that path. So I would say no.
Hard no from Mike. I don't know. I'm kind of with Mike on it depends on the circumstances, right? Like if I felt, do you know what? Yeah, I'm ready to just give it all up and go, right? Then yeah, I'd say yes, because if that's the way to get home, then why wouldn't I do it? You know? But I think it's easy to say yes, and then it's a different thing when you get there. Like I remember in Awake, when I can't remember who it was, but he was talking about Guruji, and he said that even Guruji, he found it difficult to endure his discipline. And Guruji had a as he says himself, quite a loving discipline. So it's hard to really say, isn't it? I mean, there's a part of you that wants to go, yeah, I'd be so up for it, you know, but actually could I endure it? I don't know.
What if I sweeten the deal and say, like, you can try it for a few, 18 months, and then you can write a best-selling book called Think Like a Monastic.
How I failed monastic life.
How do I follow that up?
Yeah. Jack, I thought you were going to say, like, sweeten the deal. You know, you could try it for 18 months, and if you didn't like it, it's still okay. You're still going to go home. I thought what you were going to say.
No, I don't think it's...
I thought you were going to... You were going to offer a part-time option or something.
Yeah. It might have something to do with karma. Like we know, obviously, the situation that Guruji's in is going to be very different to the rest of humanity, really, how many people have walked in his footsteps. But kind of reminds me, like, Guruji saying that he wanted to run off to the mountains and he was, you know, stopped. To say that, no, actually, your path is somewhat different. So we all have our own paths, and not many people have this path in life, which isn't to be knocked, you know. And it's not to say one is necessarily better than the other, but certainly, certainly it's a rare thing for sure. For sure, I'll stick to my Zoom for now.
Brother Muktananda was telling me that he, like, self-imposes drastic measures for himself. Like he told me he sits like cross-legged on the floor for virtually any time he's stationary. He sits cross-legged, whether that's on a desk. He's got a low desk. He's always sitting, not just cross-legged, actually, Padmasana, so full lotus. So he meditates full lotus. He eats full lotus, and he. So that's his default position. And then he said they've got an old sledge near Mother Center or something. And every day he, like, puts on like 100 kilos on the sledge and just pulls it along the car park 10 times a day or something to, like, maintain his physical drastic measures. But he's one of those that loves the asanas and hatha yoga. So he's, like, keeping his body primed. Like he does the energization videos, if you don't remember who he is, on the on the app. A perfect energization.
I want to improve my answer from before a little bit, because I think that there's something. I feel like right now I'm in the right place at the right time. And if there was something in me where I felt Guru is pushing me into a different... way of living, then I would comply at some point. I think that's often something that happens, you know, when I feel like something is wrong with my life, I need to change something. And if that's the change that is necessary, then I would probably do it at some point.
Of course, the drastic life doesn't necessarily mean that you have to commit and be a renunciant and be a monastic. There's also drastic self-imposed training in terms of, like, you know, long meditations and fasting and affirmations and all the other things that are in our path.
I don't think that's that drastic. I think I think in what he described as drastic here is his personal training he got from Sri Yukteswar, right? I don't think Mukunda would have complained about meditating and doing affirmations, but I think he was criticized at every opportunity about every little thing. And that is a very difficult thing to take for the ego, especially if you're not used to it. So I would find that difficult initially, especially, and you would have to every day anew overcome your ego and stick with it. I would think that's the challenge.
But for example, you could, I think Guruji asked us to do long meditations once a week, doesn't he? Mm-hmm. But we could mm-hmm. Do them much more often. So really, with our lesson study and with our Gita study and all those other things.
Well, true. Absolutely. And honestly, that is where the spiritual path leads, I think, eventually, that you find your joy in meditation and that you will meditate more and more, and that it will become less of a something you have to do and something that you want to do instead. Yeah, so he's a perfectionist, Swami Sri Yukteswar. And that is something, the word hypercritical struck me a little bit when I heard that, because I would usually connect it to a negative quality. But I guess when you are in the ashram and you want to learn the ways of the ashram quickly, and when you want to make progress quickly, you also need a lot of feedback. And yeah, Guruji was able to, so he doesn't really complain about it. He just describes the situation there. So it was an interesting experience for him like that. And then he makes this, he quotes Swami Sri Yukteswar, where he talks about behavior. He says that good manners without sincerity are like a beautiful dead lady. And then he says straightforwardness without civility is like a surgeon's knife, effective but unpleasant. And then candor with courtesy is helpful and admirable. So I don't know if he used like the classic sandwich method, you know, like you say something nice, then you deliver the message, and then you say something nice again at the end, if that's what he meant. But he says that it's important to be candid, but not really, but say it in a nice way.
And someone again explained to me this beautiful dead lady metaphor. I think I asked you last time, but again, I've forgotten what it means.
I feel like it's saying that, you know, if you're good manners, but you're not really sincere about it, you know, if you're a beautiful dead lady, like you look nice, but there's nothing there. There's no life in it. There's no use to anyone. It's just dead and beautiful. So it doesn't have any substance to it. That was my take. But I find it really funny, that line. I love it.
Makes sense. And the next slide is subtle nuances on ordinary behavior that Sri Yukteswar would give. I've got some examples of what this could be in the ashram context. I thought about it. For example, welcoming a guest in your home and in the ashram is a member. I told you about the old Sanskrit saying "Atithi Devo Bhava," which is a guest is God. But for example, imagine you had to honor a guest in that fashion, but you're not overly happy about the particular guest that's visiting, or the timing may be slightly off. So in that sense, you may honor the tradition, but not do it with joyfulness. And I remember in the previous page, Sri Yukteswar said he wouldn't accept anyone's service unless it was done with a joyful heart. Mm-hmm. So there could be that as well. Another thing could be, for example, offering. Sri Yukteswar used to have lots of random visitors, of which obviously they had to be very hospitable. In that respect, they may have to offer them a meal. But what if there wasn't enough food, or you were looking, that was your favorite day, favorite meal, you know, favorite food that was being cooked, and then you know knew that you weren't going to get sufficient food, or the ashram didn't have enough food, you may not do it with may not do it with such joy. It could be something like that. Another example could be if someone asks you to carry out an additional service, and this happens at the center as well. If you have to go and do what you have to do, you're there to do something, and then someone asks you to do something else as well, and you obviously always, you can't, it's hard to say no when someone asks you to do Guruji's service, but you may not have time, or you may not have too, you may have too much on your plate, and then you may accept it, and accept it with a tinge of resentment perhaps, but then that would be not good. But these are the kind of examples I could think of.
I can give you a very real one in my life that I do every single day. I interview people for a living, and I have to give straightforward feedback for a living. And I realize that with a bit of civility, with this attitude, you can say pretty much anything. You know, you if said in the right way, with the right attitude and the right with you know, trying to help and the right angle. And that can be said. Everybody's been in an interview situation. If you want to be straightforward and ask for feedback, you want to do it with some civility as well. So that's just a very practical example prepared in my world.
So are you, do you exemplify the example that Sri Yukteswar gives there, where he says candor with courtesy is helpful and admirable? Is that what, if I asked for feedback of someone that's given you feedback, or sorry, that you had given feedback, is that what they would say? Or would they say that, no, he applied the surgeon's knife approach and I'm still wounded?
Well, I suppose you would have to ask them to find out. But I mean, the interesting thing about it is that whilst it's kind of scary to be straightforward at times, I think to your point, Frank, like there's maybe a degree of confrontation in life every day that we have to deal with, but and that can be daunting. But then actually, if you deal with it in this way, this candor with courtesy, the people that I would give feedback for in this example, they all say thank you so much, because it's a rare thing. It's not very common to be this can, you know, to have straightforwardness with a bit of civility, because most people want to avoid the idea of confrontation. So yeah, if you add both of these things together, you actually have the good mix, and you can achieve a lot more together. So I'd hope they'd say good things. I don't know.
Yeah, that's a really good point, Chris. I think it's almost in our world today, the admirable thing isn't the being nice to somebody. The admirable thing is the sincerity, right? To actually say what you have to say, to actually give honest feedback, because that's something that is quite rare, especially in the business world.
You're muted, Eric.
These are superb management skills, aren't they? And that social skills that we're learning in this paragraph, you know, things like straightforwardness with civility and effective but unpleasant. So you need to be courtesy and helpful and admirable. You need to have what's it called, good manners without sincerity. So these are all really good examples for us in our both, you know, social lives and working lives.
And people can tell when you don't have them as well, which I'm guilty of. Good manners without sincerity. It's people are sensitive to these things.
Yeah, very much so. I would almost say that the surgeon's knife, I would prefer the surgeon's knife to the beautiful dead lady, to be honest, because the surgeon's knife is more like the German approach, which is more familiar to me. And that is, at least it works. The beautiful dead lady gets you nowhere, and it leaves you wondering, leaves you questioning things. So truth is definitely a good thing between in any circumstance, really. Yeah. So this is I'm guessing this was Sri Yukteswar mentioned this in response to maybe a conversation that he had with Mukunda about giving feedback, about feedback culture in the ashram that they have there. And so Sri Yukteswar was laying down the line and just said, this is the right way to do it. And this is, like Priyank said, this is a rules by which you could run a business. And this is a very healthy feedback culture. And it's important because we started out in this section with importance of discipline, and discipline is important on the spiritual path, because we need perseverance, we need to do our sadhana, and we need to try to improve our our habits and turn them into more spiritual habits. And then in the next paragraph, they talk about the spiritual progress of Mukunda and what he would criticize him about. And spiritual progress is famously something that is very hard to measure. Guruji says that often. He said we shouldn't think about it. We should never compare ourselves to others. And we should just keep at it. And only a truly realized master can really measure our spiritual progress that we are making. And nobody else really can do that, how much karma we have left and such things. And he also mentions the kind of offenses or the things that he got criticized about by his guru, by Sri Yukteswar. And they were absent-mindedness. Every now and then he was in a sad mood. And then sometimes he would not observe like the etiquette of the ashram. And the last one I loved, like unmethodical ways. Unfortunately, he doesn't give an example for this, but I found that funny to read.
Yeah, that would be some nice to have some examples. I can just imagine taking long cuts for something that maybe achieved quickly. I really like that he said that he was apparently satisfied with his spiritual progress, for he seldom referred to it. So in this context, in this spiritual performance review, progress review context, apparently no news is good news, no feedback is good feedback.
Yeah, and maybe he was giving others feedback. It sounds like he was quite open to giving feedback to people, let's say, in front of other people. So Yogananda, young Mukunda, would have had some reference there. But I do like the my chief offenses. So it implies it's includes but are not limited to. And I definitely empathize with some of this list. Absent-mindedness. And in this sense, you know, we had an example of that, right, where he was meant to be meditating Yogananda, but Sri Yukteswar pulled him up and said, hey, you know, you can think about your, you know, these dreams that you're having, you know, another time. So he was thinking about his the center in the headquarters in Los Angeles and things like that. And, so it's not absent-mindedness in a real negative way, let's say, if you could be absent-minded in a negative way. But Yogananda obviously had a lot of visions and things coming in, and still this is his number one chief offense that he's listed. So it just shows that even the level of discipline Yogananda is keeping himself to.
He also, about the unmethodical ways, he continues and gives an example that when I read that at first, I was like, oh, this might sting a little bit for Mukunda, but he mentions his dad, Bhagavati. So Sri Yukteswar mentions Bhagavati as a good example of organizing your life and living a well-balanced life. Maybe that's as opposed to the occasional unmethodical ways of Mukunda. And Sri Yukteswar said that this is important to organize your spiritual life. And instead of feeling a sting, Mukunda was actually very happy with this. He describes the relationship between Bhagavati and Lahiri Mahasaya as one of mutual admiration. And he says both of them have created a beautiful inner life on the foundations of spiritual granite. So they have really created this inner happiness where nothing that happens in life is actually throwing you off balance.
It really tells us something about his dad as well, doesn't it? Guruji's father. The fact that Sri Yukteswar deeply admires Guruji's father, you know, it doesn't seem to have any sort of critique there in that sentence. So it's a good indication of what level his dad was at and the way that he was living.
Yeah, for sure.
Mm.
I think in general, Mukunda is pretty modest with his parents, who were, I think we mentioned that before, that they were very spiritually advanced people. Yeah, not your average dad, I would say.
It is lovely to think about the mutual respect, admiration, and love between the two probably most important people in your life, isn't it? It's so nice when everyone in your life kind of fit with each other, isn't it? And this is what Mukunda is blessed enough to be having. Because imagine if the inverse was the case, and, you know, heaven forbid, father was a bad influence, or father didn't approve of Sri Yukteswar, or vice versa. It would just be chaos or hell on earth, wouldn't it, for poor little Mukunda?
Mm. Yeah, at this point in his life, Mukunda's life, it seems like everything has come together. His spiritual life, his relationship to his family, they look pretty good. On the point of creating spiritual granite, there's a little reading in Journey of Self-Realization. There is a chapter there called The Art of Getting Along in the World. And there's a section there called Ask Yourself If You Are Getting Along with God. Chris, would you mind reading the first part?
My master was a great soul. Such souls you will read about when I have completed my book, Autobiography of a Yogi. He never brought his ideals down to the level of his disciples. He was firm and uncompromising, but he used to tell me that my ways were softer than his. I understood him. And what he did for me, no words of this world can ever possibly describe. I would rather be trampled by his scoldings than be enthroned in a castle without God. I always told him my foremost craving was to get along with God.
Every day you should ask yourself, have I gotten along with God? Do you know what are the signs that you have not gotten along with God? They are restlessness, unhappiness, and an uneasy conscience. But if you are getting along with God, your conscience is at rest, and you are drunk with inner happiness and contentment all the time. I have no other desire but to be in that happiness and to give those living waters of joy to whoever comes to me.
Something that stood out to me in that reading was about conscience. I think, Lauren, you probably know what I'm going to say about having an uneasy conscience and the feeling of guilt. Brother Muktananda, he was giving a satsang to us young adults, and he said he gave a very beautiful talk about guilt and how it doesn't belong on the spiritual path, because he was saying, for example, say you do something wrong and you feel guilty, your conscience pulls you up and you feel that you have done something wrong, etc. So you know that you've done something wrong at that point, right? And you can choose to end it there by learning the lesson and not doing it again. But if you feel guilt, then that guilt will gnaw away at you. It'll impact your unhappiness. It'll make you, essentially, probably make you wreck. Your meditation won't be as good. You might start doubting. So he was saying, after you've done the thing, then essentially you're going to pay for it. You know, God is, you know, the ways of karma are exacting. So you're going to pay regardless. But if you feel guilt and remorse and you stick with that guilt feeling, then you're double charging yourself. And he was saying, like, if you got a speeding ticket, within the government gave you a speeding ticket, you just pay the fine, right? You wouldn't pay the fine and then choose to pay again and again. And that is what you're essentially doing by not just having the guilt, but the impact and the influence of guilt if you retain that guilt feeling. So he was really like just warning us against the feeling of guilt, and letting that kind of rule our lives.
Yeah, this is very, very important and totally rings true to me. I find when guilt is something that is like someone sends you an email with feedback or something like that. And I feel like what the mind loves to do is, instead of just taking this and moving on, is reading that email over and over and over again, even though it's not useful. And I have a example recently. I went to Mexico for 2 weeks and my sadhana there wasn't amazing. I didn't put in the time, and there was some days where I didn't have the time to meditate because we were constantly moving from one place to the next. And then I felt guilty about that. Then I came back home and my routine went back to normal. And I still felt guilty. And I felt like, why am I now feeling guilty now? Now I'm meditating. But it had just become a habit to feel guilty for nothing. So it's really something that you gotta be careful with, I think. It's not necessarily something that's good to dwell on. Just it sometimes shows you go in, mend your ways, but don't dwell on guilt for sure. That's not useful. Chris?
I should say it's not saying don't have a conscience. It's to say don't have an uneasy one. There are some people in the world that just would throw it away, you know, throw away the conscience entirely. But this is saying if you have an uneasy one, to distinguish is important, Prayag.
Yes. One of the other things that he said was that the primary message of the Bhagavad Gita was that one should own you only have a right to act and the actions. The result is for God to see and to look at. And this kind of comes back to the feeling of guilt, because if you own the guilt and you just, you know, allow yourself to be in a negative kind of spiral, you're taking responsibility for the results of your action. But if you've learned from that action and you, you know, promise not to do it again, you pray to God, you apologize, all those kind of things, then you're giving it back to God. And then you're living true to that that message. Again, Brother Muktananda made this point in the inspirational service that you know, we can only take care of the actions, the results are for God, and that's his business.
Yeah, absolutely. And if we move to the next paragraph, those next two paragraphs are beautiful. They're like beautiful Sri Yukteswar stories. I find his candor and the way he phrases things is just, I think when you are actually there and he tells you this, you would probably not want to, you would not find it too funny, but it's just, when I read it now, I always have to chuckle. It's really great. And Guruji says when he came to the ashram, he had learned from a previous teacher how it is not that important to perform certain tasks, worldly duties, and focus more on the spiritual. And focusing on the spiritual is definitely the right thing, but neglecting your worldly tasks and being careless is not a great quality. Yes, Brian?
Yeah. He said he imbibed a few erroneous lessons from a transient teacher from his earlier life. And I can relate to that. Before I came to Guruji and became a Kriyaban, I remember I was doing asana a lot, which is Hatha Yoga postures, and I was getting really into it. And one of the things they were teaching you was you assist each other in deepening the stretch. And you might do this in yoga classes in the gyms around the world that you're in. But yeah, they kind of, you know, you help each other get a bit further in the stretch. And this is like probably the thing you can do, because you're basically going beyond the limits of your body. And so when I did this once with the teacher, I pulled my lower back And then there was a bit of a spasm. And then every like year or two, I'd get that same impact after like bending and lifting something. And to this day, like when I'm doing my Mahamudra Kriyas or other asanas, I still have to go within my limit because I know that there's a very tender spot there. So this lesson is like etched in my physical being, like doing things the wrong way, how it could impact you for the rest of pretty much the rest of your life.
Yeah, and I think doing things the wrong way is also something that someone like Sri Yukteswar would never allow. But there's one of the sentences I really liked here was, under master's unsparing rod, however, I soon recovered from the agreeable delusions of irresponsibility. And then he has some really good quotes, some real singers in there. I think this one here, those who are too good for this world are adorning some other. And then he continues, so long as you breathe the free air of earth, you are under obligation to render grateful service. Only he who fully mastered the breathless state, samadhi, is freed from cosmic imperatives, he added. And then he added dryly, I shall not fail to let you know when you have attained the final perfection. Okay. just gotta love that. So it's really thinking that because you are on a spiritual path means you don't have to serve others. You don't have to serve a cause, or you don't have to serve your family. It's just not true. It's just the opposite is true. It's part of your being in harmony with God's laws is to render service.
Do you know in the line in the middle there, so long as you breathe the free air of the earth, you are no longer, you are under obligation to render grateful service. Did you read in that a bit of an oxymoron? Because when you
the free air,
when you breathe it, yeah, it's not free, right? It's the air is not free one way or the other. You're gonna have to pay for that air, whether it's rendering grateful service or through some, you know, other health thing or whatever. But there's nothing, you have to give back, right? There's nothing, every bit that God gives you here is you have to essentially pay back in one way or the other.
Are you saying Earth is a scam, Priyank? I think you are.
Yeah. It's a big scam. Maya is a scam. What a scam. So alluring, yet so damning.
Yeah, they call it free, but it's not free. You owe it service. Yeah, so he was, again, Mukunda never complained about any of those sentences by Sri Yukteswar. I think he shares them here in this book because he wants to promote them. They're very important on the spiritual path.
Also, the other point here I wanted to make was that only he has fully mastered the breathless state. And this is he's calling that the English translation for samadhi. So only one who has mastered samadhi is freed from cosmic imperatives, which is an interesting translation of samadhi. I think probably unique this time. Because before he kind of calls it Satchitananda, ever conscious, ever new bliss consciousness and all that kind of stuff. Whereas here he's saying breathless state, mastering it.
So once you master it, you're free. You cannot be, somebody tells you do the dishes, you're like, nope, I'm in the breathless state. but you could probably do the dishes with some miraculous powers then, so you wouldn't be a problem, I would say. Anyways, we have reached the end of this part. Does anyone still want to add something to part 10 of chapter 12?
No.
Then thank you, three. Thank you to our listeners and to everyone who's watching this on YouTube. And stay tuned for the next part. Jai Guru.
Jai Guru.